Welcome to the Urban Farming Podcast. My name is Chris Late. I've been urban farming for about 2 years now, and we really here to get the notion of urban farming as a potential solution to food security on track. So please hit the subscribe button, like us on Facebook, and to send us what you would like to know and understand better about urban farming. Hi, it's Chris Late here, urban farmer, and this is my very first podcast. Very excited about it, and we've got a number of interesting topics about urban farming. What is it? How do you do it? Why do you do it? And to help us, I've invited Rika, Rika Joubert. Rika is in many ways the inspiration behind the fact that I became an urban farmer. I'm probably that typical story of a corporate executive, overweight, rushed, no time, no nothing. I met Rika through cycling, and she started making me aware of nutrition and the value of good food. Rika, would you mind just introducing yourself a little bit? I know you're a personal trainer, I know you're a well-known cycle photographer, but please just give some background and what you'd hope to bring over to the listener.
Thank you, Chris. I'm very honored to be here. And it is a passion of mine to nutrition and also how we go about getting our food and how we go about treating ourselves and treating our planet. And you know, I'm not a fundamentalist at all, but to some extent I like to have a soft approach towards the way I live and towards myself. So And yes, I'm a personal trainer and I'm a photographer.
And I can also maybe mention you've got a agricultural background from your upbringing.
Yes, so. I grew up in Bonnievale and my father was a farmer and I have a brother who's a farmer.
Rika, I mean, if we look at urban farming, and what is interesting is that there's more people living in cities now than ever. Urban farming is probably not a unique concept at any stretch of the imagination. But I recently read that more than half of the world's population currently live in cities. And in the developed world, that's like approaching 70% of people's living in cities. And I think one of the concerns is that a lot of questions is being asked about the sustainability of providing food to the cities in the ways of in the traditional ways. I mean, if we look at something like a head of lettuce, according to a recent survey in the United States, an average head of lettuce travels more than 1,000 miles from that it's harvested until it's consumed. So there is probably opportunity to sort of take urban farming as a potential solution to the food crisis. What's your view on this?
Well, that's absolutely shocking, seeming that lettuce is one of the easiest things to grow in a pot or in your backyard or, you know, and you really don't need a lot of space. I live right in the middle of the city. I have a little balcony, and I actually grow quite a bit of vegetables that on my balcony. So, and the nice thing for me is that I know the lettuce and the vegetables that I produce on my balcony, that there's no pesticides on them, and I know that the soil is really nutritious and I think it is really shocking. And there's minimal work actually going into producing a lettuce yourself. You can actually even produce it on your windowsill.
Mm. Well, I think I've been tinkering with aquaponics for probably the last 8 years. And it's just amazing when my eyes went open to the realization that in one cubic meter here in my courtyard at the kitchen door, I've actually got an extra fridge, and I've got an extra pharmacy, and you know, now obviously my benefit there was it's within a concrete courtyard, so yes. Yeah, I'd have to use pots or so, but with the aquaponics tout, the fish produces the fertilizer.
Yes.
And you know, Rico, what is fascinating, and I try to try and, you know, document, yes, the harvest and so on, you tend to forget those things, but I actually figured out that roughly about 18 to 20 months you've paid for your system by virtue of just not, you know, buying, yes, those off the shelf anymore.
I think you and me, you are a proper urban farmer. I have a few pots and I grow, you know, a few vegetables on my balcony. So, and I'm not scientific at all. I really just, actually a lot of the seeds and things that grow on my balcony is just, mm-hmm, coming from my compost. So, mm-hmm, it just, you know, it just started growing on its own. I made an effort to buy heirloom lettuce seeds. So they're actually like weeds. They plant themselves continuously. Yeah. So there's very little. I am not signed. You know, I'd sort of let nature do its thing.
Yeah.
You know, so I think it's seasonal as well. So there's, you know, whatever grows in what season, that's just the way it is.
Well, I think two points there. One is there's definitely, in my opinion, an international trend around what is fresh, what is local, and what is in season. And I think that's quite powerful.
The thing about nature that is so miraculous and so wonderful is that it actually produces the nutrients that we need in specific seasons. You know, I look at the purslane, which is actually a weed that we pull out. Mm-hmm. But that specific little weed only comes in a certain part of this specific part of the year, and then, you know, most people will just pull it out and it's see it as a weed, but it's actually a very rich source of omega-3 fatty acids. And in areas that's really cold, there's actually more omega-3 fatty acids in the plant. So it's, you know, like nature just puts in the plant what we need.
What we need, absolutely. Well, yeah, I think there's still room for a lot of research in terms of that. Maybe just, sorry, back one topic. When you expressed heirloom seed, my understanding is it's actually seed that's not been genetically manipulated, and yeah, it's like hair in terms of you inherited it.
Yes.
From a
yes. So I think originally all seeds were heirloom seeds, and then My brother, who's an apple farmer, you know, they produce very specific varieties of apple. So you will get your Granny Smith, and you'll get your Golden Delicious apples, and you'll get your the red apples, and you know, so you get all those different varieties. And that's, I think, that is what is hybridized seeds.
Yeah.
So and I think nowadays when you go to the nursery and you buy a packet of seeds, then you know, the carrots are hybridized to have specific characteristics.
Yeah. No, well, I brought you a pumpkin, and if I look at that guy, it's doesn't look like the original pumpkin that you buy for Halloween, but I'm quite curious to taste it, because it's organic, and it grew out of exactly that seeds that I had.
Yes. What I've heard actually about even genetically modified seeds, if you plant them and over a few generations, they'll actually return to their original genetic structure.
Okay.
So, you know, they will lose that genetic modification. I'm no expert on what the difference is between hybridized seeds and genetically modified seeds. No,
I think, you know, what is the lesson I'm getting from you is there's room to utilize what you have, you know, out of buying a cucumber or a pumpkin or whatever, especially if you maybe got it on a farmer's market or so.
Yes.
There's actually value in retaining those seeds and seeing where you can plant it.
Yes.
Maybe let's just have a look at, you know, often people would think about urban farming and say, but you know, now I've got too many birds in my garden, and what do I do about insecticides? And what's your feeling been on that topic?
I told you that I'm a failed urban farmer because two of my gardens that I made, I made one at work, and I had lurie birds in you know, it's I'm lucky to have such a beautiful gym, and it's in like a really beautiful garden and with lots of birds, and fortunately the birds discovered my garden, and they finished off my garden, except for the spinach. So the spinach survived, and I put a net over it, so that, you know, that helped a little bit. And I just started over again. You know, luckily I'm not completely dependent on my little, you know, for me, it makes a difference to what I consume. I spend less on vegetables. I really like my green juice every day, and I like eating my green leafy vegetables. And just, you know, for example, I looked at your pumpkin and I thought, well, I hope this is a pumpkin that has lots of leaves, because I actually use the pumpkin leaves as well. So even though my pumpkin plant on my balcony hasn't produced a pumpkin yet, you know, I even use the leaves. So the actual fruit of the plant doesn't have to be perfect as well.
Well, I think the lesson that I've learned, and it's probably one of the, let's call it permaculture principles, is go and harvest. You know, if you don't take it, nature will.
Yes, definitely.
I think, you know, maybe just my two cents on it is that I was very concerned about pests. I think environmental factors is a major driver of agriculture cost. But then I started reading up on fighting bugs with bugs.
Yes.
And that's just made such a big difference. I mean, I've been farming now, full-time for probably been urban farming for about 8 years, but I've been full-time urban farming now for the last almost year and a half, and I don't use any pesticides, nothing. And it's just, you know, the moment you see aphids on your plants, day or two later you start seeing ladybugs, and three or four days later the ladybug sorted out the aphids. You know?
Well, one of the things with aphids, for example, is that, you know, if it also depends on the nutrition of your soil and what's happening in the soil. So if there's too many nitrates in the soil, then it's nearly like there's sugar in the soil.
Yeah.
And then the plant is sweeter, and then you have more aphids. So, you know, we like to buy the 515 for the roses, but there's a lot of nitrates in that specific formula, and often that changes the composition of the soil, and it attracts a lot of aphids, and it can ruin your garden.
Well, I think that's fascinating about the value that I'm now seeing in terms of farming organically. As long as you sort of stick to that recipe, you actually get less bugs.
Yes.
It's amazing. Yeah.
Yes, and for example, one of the things that I've done is I've planted garlic, which a lot of pests doesn't like, the fact that there's garlic as well. I've planted garlic chives as well. It deters the pests to some extent.
Well, I think that's an interesting topic also around companion plants. For example, what I do, one of the lines that I sell is edible flowers, which sort of this time of the year tend to go down.
Yes.
And then I like to plant marigolds in their space, which is also edible.
Yes.
But the marigolds, Afrikanerkies, they are nitrogen fixers, you know. So that's also something that I think you can elaborate on.
Yeah, well, I've learned that from you now.
Let's maybe move on to why would you say is urban farming important? Why would the average listener perhaps driving in his or her car saying, you know, guys, quite frankly, that's how the economy works. We can't do all All of us can't start doing everything in an economic cycle. There must be guys that do farming, and I'll do yes. my business, etc., etc. Yes.
I think for me personally, you know, I find that it really relaxes me. I have quite a stressful, you know, I have a long day that's very stressful, and I have sometimes during the day I have a little gap. I stay about 6 kilometers from my work. Mm. And I find that it really relaxes me to work in my garden, so that's one reason. The other is that the bugs that live in the soil is actually very good for my own immune system, and that's what I wanted to say,
okay.
is that, you know, just like we have an immune system, and when we are exposed to germs in our environment, our immune system becomes stronger. Mm. When the plant is exposed to certain bugs or certain pests, it also develops immunity against those bugs. And that is actually a plant that has, you know, that wasn't pampered completely, is actually a much more nutritious and a much better plant to, you know, if we look at, I don't know if you're familiar with something called sulforaphane.
No.
That's an extract that we get from broccoli or from the cruciferous vegetables, specifically broccoli sprout is very, very high in sulforaphane, and it's... in the nutritional circles, it's like a buzzword because it slows down aging. It actually can reverse aging to a tremendous extent, and it's you know, it's one of those wonderful things that science brought us.
But and that's why we're the same age, but you look half my age.
No, I don't know about that. 10 years of working, of chasing cycling races in the sun. But I feel very healthy and I feel very vibrant.
Yeah, no, it's, I can see there's a healthy glow about you.
Thank you.
Actually, it's interesting. I recently had a conversation with a lady that's one of the top permaculturists in South Africa. And permaculture is sort of, the word comes from permanent agriculture.
Yes.
It's using no-till techniques and companion planting and etc. But she's a fascinating lady, and she attends many of the international conferences and so on. And she started farming, urban farming, for her own health reasons. She just realized that, you know, 40 minutes of working in the garden twice a week is certainly adding to her life expectancy.
Yes, you know, you're in the sun, you get the vitamin D. Also, the pests, you know, it's difficult to find organically grown vegetables. I'm looking for somebody like you in Johannesburg, but I live about a 45 minutes drive away from the organic market, and organic vegetables are really expensive, and it's hard to find. You know, you often go to the shop, and it's not that easy to find organically grown vegetables.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting just to note also that, and I've been monitoring it, that organic, the prices are coming down. But it's fascinating that, you know, there's a company in the United States under creation, I think it's farmlands.com. And that's what they do. They rehabilitate big-scale commercial chemical farms back to organic farms.
Yes.
And, you know, when one look at the business case, you'd say, but that's crazy because, you know, for a chemical farm to be rehabilitated, it means it needs to lay barren for 5 years. Now, 5 years is a long time.
Yes, it's a long time for a farmer to be without an income.
Absolutely. But, you know, and then we say, but why is organic food so difficult? But it's often because, you know, of that 5 years that the land had to be barren that needs to be discounted. But again, I think the health benefits probably do justify it in the end.
Yes. And also, as we do struggle with climate change, I think... as we move more towards a permaculture model of farming, and, you know, it's actually our farms will become much more resistant to the changes in climate. You know, if we have trees, and if we have shrubs, and we have creepers, and we have different kinds of plants all growing together, that's a farm that's much more resistant to what's happening in nature. My brother, for example... on his farm about a month ago, he had a hailstorm, 30-second hailstorm.
Oh, goodness,
and it destroyed a good 20% of his harvest.
Now, I think it's fascinating. Well, when I started looking into the agribusiness side of things, I realize that there's four major cost drivers. You know, firstly is your environmental factors, pesticides, hail, drought, etc. That's probably the major cost drivers, because I think there's few businesses that can actually escalate that quickly, going from 1 to 2 to 4 to 8 to 16. But there's few other businesses that comes down from 16 to 0
yes.
as quickly as farming. If there's not a method of controlling the environment to a certain extent. So obviously what you get, it's like in the Netherlands, you know, they protect against cold, etc., with indoor farming.
Yes.
And just interesting, they've over the last 2 years, they've surpassed China. They're now the world's second biggest food exporter after the USA.
Wow, that's an amazing fact.
Yeah. But I think the potential maybe future sort of permaculture type farming is built on a different model, where, you know, I'm assuming now, but you know, apple farmer, if or let's say even more a maize farmer, you know, if he can get his produce out a week before his neighbor, he's in a lot better financial position, where permaculture is not that. It's the time when the specific crop is ready.
Yes.
You need to be ready to eat.
Yes.
It, and I think your example of how nature's actually given us those plants in certain times of the year to boost our immune system is remarkable.
I think there's a space for both. I think if more of us can make a little garden at home, where we have, you know, whether it's nasturtiums or whether it's carrots or whether it's beetroot or what, most vegetables actually grow very easily.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we supplement what we have. You know, we can supplement what we get from the shop with organic vegetables that we've grown ourselves.
And yeah, you mentioned beforehand your because you know, one of the topics that I'd like to cover here in more detail in the future is what to plant and when to plant. You know, but Rika mentioned to me that she's got a celery plant that's been with her for a number of years. Now most people grow celery and when it's ready I harvest the whole plant because the
yes.
chefs kind of demand that. But and you've got celery
yes,
to
I,
be cut and grow again.
Yeah. It's actually two things. So one is with celery, for example, I've just been cutting pieces of the plant off and I've been watering the plant, and other than that I've actually done very little. I don't think, well, maybe I have a worm farm, so I've put a little bit of worm castings on the plant, and I water it, and even the water that I use to water my garden with is actually my bath water.
Yeah,
so
grey water. Yeah,
grey water. So, the other thing is, the moment a plant is experiencing any kind of hardship, it actually starts making seeds.
Mm.
You know, so most plants when they feel under pressure, they want to make sure that the genetic footprint stays and they produce seeds and they will reproduce themselves.
Mm. Yeah, that's interesting. And I think, yeah, obviously many plants thrive on the fact that you frequently harvest them and handle them more often. And that brings back that old cliche about the best fertilizer for a plant is the shade of the farmer.
Yes, yes. And, you know, it's we see that with flowers. The more if you have a rose bush in your garden, the more you cut the flowers, the more roses it will produce, you know. So.
Yeah, I had a wonderful experience 2 weeks ago. I harvested all the borage flowers, and I thought I'd probably only see borage flowers again in 4 weeks' time. But the next week there was actually a greater harvest than the previous week. So
yeah,
1 week, amazing.
Amazing. It's just nature that's amazing. Yeah. Actually, it continuously surprised me, and the wonder of it stuns me. And I think that for me, as the minute scale farmer that I am, you know, for me there's that connection that I, living in the city, I feel that when I work with my plants, that I develop a connection with the soil, and that, you know, I see how I am interlinked with nature. I feel connected with nature.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, again, as we said earlier, I mean, with more than half of the planet's people living in cities, I think that's a massive need. I know one of my sort of virtual mentors in urban farming is Curtis Stone from Canada. And he started noticing food security and the issue around that with the Great Recession at the end of the 90s. And that stimulated him to become probably one of the world's most famous urban farmers now. But
yes.
It started out of a realization that, hey, you know, if the economy can crash, what happened to my food? You know?
Yes, exactly. And for me, just practically, you know, often I come home and I haven't been to the shops. And I don't have green vegetables that I've bought from the shops. And then I can just go out on my balcony and it's there and it's convenient.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, it's... And I think the challenge around year-round harvesting is there's a bit of an input that's required when you start putting out your urban farm, is to know what, you know, is harvestable when and what grows when and so on. But I mean, I've showed you my orchard.
Yes, I've seen your fantastic. You've made a study of it. It's wonderful.
Well, and just it's a very simple concept. I just wanted, I had space in a concrete courtyard and pots, and I wanted something that bears fruit every month. And I actually, in the end, managed to figure that out.
Yes, so. But I think in the olden days when people were less reliable on the market for their food, everybody had an orchard. You know, I remember my grandfather... Yeah. We had apple and guava, and we had fruits in winter, and we had figs. And I do remember that we were very aware of the birds. We always protected the figs from the birds and the apples and so on. So,
well, I think there's, you know, definitely a cyclical scenario. I think people want that. But an interesting thing that I haven't noticed before, but which is gaining momentum, is people wanting an edible fruit forest in their garden. They want a aesthetically pleasing garden with maybe not too much maintenance, but everything that grows in that garden must be edible.
We often think that, you know, an apple tree or a fruit tree is not as aesthetically pleasing as another kind of tree. But actually, an apple tree in blossom is actually stunningly beautiful. It's same with a peach tree or a plum tree.
And I mean, a lemon tree is year-round green.
Yes.
And then let's not throw away many of our indigenous trees. That's lovely fruit bearing.
Yes.
Thinking about the kai apple, for example. Can't think of the English word now. So, Rico, I think we've touched on, you know, some of the nutritional benefits. We've touched on the physical and emotional component and benefits of that. Maybe what we should have a look at also is the methodology. What can one do? You know, if I was thinking about planting my own food, where would you recommend one start?
Well, I think it depends on your specific situation. But like I said, if I can do it, living in the middle of the city and in a block of flats, then I think most other people can do that. And you know, you can start a garden on the pavement, and even that is very rewarding because you share with all your neighbors. I think I started. One of the things is I also recycling. I recycle in my house, so I wanted to actually recycle all the peels and things from the kitchen. So I started with a worm farm, and bokashi bin, so all my, you know, all my peels chicken, and things goes into the bokashi bin.
Yeah.
I wish I actually had chickens at one stage. Okay. My chickens are now full on pasture raised chickens. They've become really wild.
Oh, okay.
They lived a good life. And
but aren't they just the greatest composters that you can find?
Yes, they are, but they will also they will ruin your garden if it's a very pedicured garden. Yeah. So
no, well, I think that maybe then, you know, in summary, there's no reason why anybody, there's no excuse really for anybody not to look at planting some of their own foodstuffs. I do think it's, one needs to be a little bit, you can't be naive. Something like traditionally foodstuff that can be preserved tend to be not typically things that in the urban environment. I'm talking about, you know, mealies, you know, grains, potatoes, that type of thing. You can plant it, but, you know, it's probably what more suited for bigger monocrop kind of areas there. Where I think the perishable foodstuffs is it's really a valuable attribute to have that foodstuff closer to the market. And I realize not everybody wants to farm for commercial purposes. But maybe let's just explore that topic for one moment. Do you think that it's viable to farm beyond your own needs in an urban environment?
Yes, definitely. I think if you make, I had a pavement garden at one stage, and well, I don't have it anymore, but the whole neighborhood, and it was wonderfully educational as well. Yeah. You know, all the children. Yeah. A lot of children actually didn't know what the carrot looked like when it was still in the soil, or what a beetroot looked like when it was still in the soil.
Mm. No, well, I think it's probably one of the things that we'll see is with the sort of gaining of popularity of urban farmers per se. More food, farmers markets, more food festivals, more of these type of things might become more prominent in South Africa specifically. It's already in other parts of the world.
And what I see nowadays is a lot of schools or at a lot of community halls or, you know, places where you normally wouldn't expect a little garden or a little farm. You suddenly see now that people looking after the properties there are actually farming there as well.
Absolutely, yeah. All right, well, I think we need to look at what we're going to do next week. Rick, I think next week let's look at, I'd like to address the topic about, all right, what do you do? Where do you start? You know, what is the potential techniques available to me? There might be people that's got a space on their balcony on the 12th floor. There might be people that says, you know, I've got a lawn in the backyard that, you know, we can utilize. There might be people that say, you know what, I'd like to put a tunnel up on top of the roof of the building.
Maybe have hydroponics.
Exactly. You know, and I think let's look at some of the techniques and skills that you require. But to summarize, I think urban farming is becoming a movement. I think it's the utilization of unused urban areas for agricultural purposes is something that's starting to be taken more serious with local municipalities, with developers, with landscapers, and people generally, like you said, wants a bigger feel in terms of where their food comes from and how valuable it is. And looking at your list of clients, definitely the shift, just what it did in my life in terms of understanding what I eat has got a dramatic effect on my physicality. What would you like to wrap up with, Rico?
Well, I think you can start. You must just start, actually. Just do it.
Just do it.
Yes, but we can talk about that.
Right, let's talk about that next week. Rika, thank you very much for joining me.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for listening. If you haven't done so already, please hit the subscribe button, hit the like button, click the link on Facebook where you can review us and tell us what content you'd like. We aim to bring you the very best in content. Thank you very much. This is Chris Late signing out. Until next time, keep farming.